This is Jim DeBacchus on the left, getting ready for our fabulous legislative preview session.
And Greg Hughes on the right in this corner. Let's get ready to rumble, Jim. Session starts Monday.
And I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle, a weekly discussion about politics and critical issues facing Utah. This week, we do our 2014 legislative session preview. We talk about clean air and the Convention Headquarters Hotel. But first, this news.
I'm Jim DeBacchus on the left.
And Greg Hughes on the right.
And Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. And we're here today on Both Sides of the Aisle, a lively, informative conversation about politics and issues in Utah. Today, we are right before the 2014 legislative session. And on Tuesday night, our chief executive, Governor Herbert, will be addressing us in his State of the State address. This is typically carried live by all the network stations. You've got 104 legislators in attendance. And the question is, the way we're going to start out this segment, what do you want to hear the governor say? Jim?
I went last year. It's very cool. You sit in a, I don't have a seat anywhere near as close as Hughes because he is really important and all of that. So I was in the hallway with the interns, and I enjoyed it. I think it's good. And I would hope that the governor actually gets substantive.
Yeah, that'd be neat to see, wouldn't it?
You know, we just need some serious proposals. Generally, I think a state of the whatever ought to be 50,000 feet. It ought to be lofty. But in this governor's case, I would hope he would be real specific.
I'm thinking it's an ideal time for him to announce his decision on Medicaid expansion. Greg, what are you looking for?
You know, I think it's an aspirational speech. I think it's to inform the listening audience, the viewing audience, where this state stands. I think it's economy, what the world looks like in Utah, especially in contrast to the rest of the country, which the picture, I believe, is pretty bright. But then let's get down to clean air. Let's talk about education and transportation. And an issue near and dear to my heart, Natalie, is that prison relocation. 700 acres of economic development for this state, corporate expansions, relocations, greater tax base. There requires some leadership there, and would love to see that as part of the speech.
Yeah. Greg, what is aspirational?
Yeah. A Republican that is aspirational. I know this is a disjointed moment
sure
for you.
Make sure I get it right. There's no insult involved.
No,
all right, good.
We are looking forward and giving the good news, Jim, of what Republican leadership will bring this state.
But, you know, when you're involved, as Governor Herbert tries to think about what he's going to put in his State of the State, I mean, there's so many issues. So the first thing he has to do is prioritize. And then he also has to use language and imagery that's actually you want to listen to for, 35 minutes or whatever he's going to go for. You're using a teleprompter. And that takes away from sort of the spontaneity of the moment. Typically, governors in State of the State addresses have what I'm going to call stunt babies. Good term,
yes.
Huh? They have up in the gallery Mark Eaton, saying something. You point to him and he represents something. I'm hoping that we have a governor that is at this point quite seasoned in his leadership, and he draws upon the full tools of a governor to deliver an impactful address.
You know, my gripe with governors, and I go back to Leavitt, to Huntsman, and now to Gary Herbert, they all have been very popular in the high 60s, the 70s, and they store up like a squirrel with a patch of nuts, and they seem that popularity, and they don't seem willing to risk that popularity and everything they are stored up to do something dramatic, something that's a bit counterculture, something mm-hmm. that will change the state. They're saving it all up, but in the case of Huntsman, I think it basically went away unused. So if you're at 70% and you have 80% of the legislature and you got pretty high popularity ratings, it's time. It's time to take this speech. It's time to do something with that popularity and recognize that you may drop 10 points, but sacrifice it for creating a vision and something new and something forceful that you're passionate about in the state. I don't think Leavitt did it very well. I don't think Huntsman did it very well. I really don't believe Governor Herbert has. And I would hope that aspirationally, that's what would happen with this speech and with this governor.
Be neat to see. Greg, you have something to add there?
The most uncomfortable part of the show for me is when I'm agreeing with Jim. And I'm telling you right now that there's a formula there, Jim, and why governors are successful is you stay popular by not offending anyone. Mm-hmm. The way you don't offend people is to not do anything. Not to be too critical of our good governor, but I will tell you that there are leadership strategies. I would love to see, and it's been my approach, and it's why friends in politics come and go and enemies accumulate, especially as a lawmaker. But I have my fair share of enemies, but I do think that you ought to spend political capital, and I think you need to put some stakes in the ground and get things done.
So I'm a veteran of the Leavitt administration, and there have been some things said here, so I'm going to have to stand up and defend myself just a little bit.
I expected you would, Natalie.
Tell me you're not using political capital when you go before your convention as the sitting party leader and governor of the state and get booed. That was Mike Leavitt using political capital on guns in churches, on public land trades. Okay, so I'm looking at Jim. I mean, do I get some points there for saying he used some political capital? I mean, he got booed at his convention.
Natalie, touche.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's one thing, though, to get that fringy group out of the Republican caucus angry, but pretty much you sneeze the wrong way and they're hysterical. Yeah. So, I'll give you points though.
Okay, well, it gives us a good chance. Go ahead,
and
Greg.
good governors. When you say that, Natalie, I think of the vetoes that Governor Herbert decided to make in legislative sessions, appearing before a Republican convention as well on gun rights. There were some bills that were popular with conservatives that he vetoed, and he stood in that same gauntlet. He stood and faced delegates as well. So there, it's not absent. It's not completely devoid of political courage. I just it gets me excited when we have big lifts and big carries to do in a session.
Well, so a big lift we need, and we need it ASAP. We're sitting here this week with Sundance in town, and you go on the EPA website and it talks about the two worst places for air quality in the country right now, and Logan and Salt Lake City are at the top of that list. It's just unbelievable that we find ourselves there, and it calls for big action. Why wouldn't the governor in his State of the State address call for some pretty revolutionary things in air quality? Greg, since you're in the same party as the governor, what do you think?
I think you'll see that. I think you're going to see some bold steps by this governor.
Jim just rolled his eyes.
You're going to see. Look, I do not believe there's a law that exists that a bunch of politicians can create to change this air quality in some magical way. There is a populace that needs to be educated on what it means to be careful with this environment and how we use our cars and when we idle and those things. There's education that needs to happen. You don't want a regulatory climate that chases out economy in this valley either. We've got businesses, good businesses that are here. It takes a collaborative effort, but you will see effort, and it will be a positive step forward.
Jim, you're critical of this governor's leadership on air quality.
And legislature.
Okay, lay it out very quickly. What should they be doing that they're not?
It's the same problem that I have come with the legislature and with the governor and the whole Republican establishment, which is they are ideological and not practical and reasonable. So if you have to filter everything through these ideological glasses, you end up blind a lot of times. This is not an insoluble problem. There is this premise that we got valleys, we're going to have this pollution, we're all going to die, and that's the way it is. It's just not true. There's places with very similar conditions that had the willpower and the leadership, and presumably that could talk directly to the guys writing the checks, the serial polluters, and say, you know what? You're right. We're giving up this dough. We're chasing you out of here because we do not want you in Logan and Salt Lake. So goodbye. We are going to increase the regulations. We're going to keep all that stuff out of the air. That could happen just the way it did in Los Angeles and Mexico City. But I don't think the Republicans have the will. They can't get over this ideological thing. And so subsequently, they're going to be having all this voluntary stuff, and nothing is going to change unless there's a dramatic change in the majority party.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. I'm joined by Jim DeBacchus on the left and Greg Hughes on the right. In our next section, we'll talk about Medicaid expansion, executive pay, and the Convention Headquarters Hotel. I'm Natalie Gochner, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm joined on the left by Jim DeBacchus. Say hello, Jim.
Hello.
And on the right by Greg Hughes.
Hello, Natalie.
Greg, in the last segment, we kind of closed it out talking about clean air. I wanted to give you a chance to just, correct all the misstatements that Jim made there about lack of leadership in clean air.
Natalie, this is public radio conspiracy. He just got a rant off, and then we go to commercial break. I get no chance to respond. Here is the issue, Jim. You talked about the ideologues on the right and the pragmatists on the left. If you think, and if you can show a formula where you can regulate an industry and chase them out, and have an economy that can still run and a successful effort in terms of cleaning up the air, show me where that goes. And don't say it's California, because they're a nightmare right now. You would never want to trade the problems that they have in that legislature, that state government, with what we're doing here in the state of Utah. 60% of the pollution in this valley and Wasatch Front are from tailpipes. Quit talking about industry. Let's talk about what the real polluters are in this valley. And let's talk about clean air. Let's talk about clean fuels. Let's talk about how cars that were built before 1994 are polluting so much more than the newer cars that are being built today. Those are the issues, and that isn't ideology. That is just a practical, pragmatist's approach to clean air.
Greg, I look at my list here on air quality, and we're doing a lot of them. Fleet conversion, you know, grants for R&D. The University of Utah is going to get some of these grants. I'm proud of that. We got a bike-friendly capital city mayor. I'd sure like to see tracks be free and the buses be free during episodes of dirty air.
There's been a lot of talk of that. Look, one of my roles as a volunteer board member of UTA, the mayors in Salt Lake County asked me to represent local governments in that governance model. I will tell you this. There's about it's $35 to $40 million in annual revenue that comes. We call it farebox collection. That would have to be an ongoing and growing revenue as we project ridership to increase. If there was a revenue source for that and our mass transit was free to the public, there'd be a strong argument that
it
would be used more. But
I think that's an appropriate role for the state to play. Step up, compensate the transit authority for lost revenues, but help clean our air.
Just remember,
get people on the trains,
that revenue enhancement is a tax increase. You have to find that tax somewhere. And so that
ideology
probably would not be as well embraced by my body.
Jim?
Natalie, look, what Greg is saying, and I think he's a fine chair of the UTA.
He is. But we can all agree on that.
And he's worth every dime they pay him.
Nothing, thanks.
You're telling me that for a shady $2.9 million, almost what we're spending on keeping non-existent wolves out, or a lot of screwball stuff, we could make the UTA absolutely, completely free. Imagine what would happen to ridership. Catch a vision of that.
Yeah.
And for those of you who have never been on UTA, imagine all of those people off the freeways. A penny a gallon gasoline increase that goes right from unclogging our roads. Who wouldn't pay that? And I just made that up. I don't know how much it would take in a change in the gas tax. But I'm saying, we're collecting all this money and going through all this for $2.9 million a month. This is the place we ought to begin, not wait for the smoggy days. Let's just say we're going to try this great experiment. We're actually going to make it free, and we're going to dramatically increase usage. That's where I'm voting.
So clean air is going to get a lot of discussion in the 2014 session. Another topic that will get discussion is the prospects of a Convention Headquarters Hotel, which by definition is adjacent to our convention center and can take a room block of like 1,000 rooms. Last year, passed the Senate, failed in the House by 4 votes. I think I've got 2 colleagues on this show that are both supportive of a Convention Headquarters Hotel for what it will do for our economy. But I've got some equity concerns, and I wanted to just kind of put those on the table. I mean, we have people who have put up private capital, risked their own money to invest in this community, and you're going to put this hotel on the north end that will take away room nights.
You know, Natalie, let me jump in because it is my role on this program to make sure that the right is well represented. And I will tell you that that equity problem that you describe is very valid. There are studies out there that say that a convention hotel would not be a rising tide that would lift all ships, that it would adversely impact some of the hotels and those that spent their own dollars without a public subsidy to put it in place. The devil, I guess, would be in the details. Right now, one of the reasons why Salt Lake City was taken off the list of cities that would look to host the National Republican Convention is the absence of a convention hotel. When these large, large events look to take place, they look for certain ingredients, certain things that would happen. Now, I've been to national conventions, and I can tell you that I've seen that rising tide, and I've seen the economic activity that occurs mm-hmm. when you have major events that arrive at your city. Are there enough of them to justify this effort? You know, the people that want this hotel are going to have to show that the structured parking that would be subsidized and the convention space hotel that would be paid for with tax increment is justified. I don't think there's any proposal that would suggest that the hotel itself or its rooms would be subsidized by the taxpayer. But those points about equity are absolutely valid and need to be verified.
The productive middle on this debate is if you've got a number of hotels who in the first 5 years, as the market has to grow into this convention, larger convention market, if they get hurt, how do you mitigate that? That's one of the productive middle places. And the other topic that you're going to hear more and more about is this notion of if we're really after citywide conventions, why not only subsidize citywide conventions instead of the whole, you know, 12 months of the year when that hotel's sitting there? So the idea is that you would give public monies to the Convention Visitors Bureau to help offset some of the costs of citywide conventions. How do you look at that, Jim?
I was for the convention hotel until Greg said that the GOP National Convention
would have come here,
and I'm changing my
opinion.
Dang
it! Why did I say that? Just change it with Democrat? Same deal.
Look at the outdoor retailers. They're our biggest convention. They've been coming for years. They get thousands of people. They drop $30 million into our economy. They create jobs. Then they get on their planes. They leave. They don't leave their kids to educate. If we had the right vision, we would understand that we need to be competing with the Anaheims and the Orlandos and the San Franciscos, not with the Boises and Albuquerques and the Colorado
Reno.
Springs
Reno.
Where we are
Pick
now.
Reno.
The Reno. I think they have better accommodation. So my point is, how do we envision the future? How do we create the environment that is going to allow us to see the outdoor retailers, not as the top of the food chain, but as the bottom, so we can bring every weekend outdoor retailers in here?
That would be something. I'll tell you that I've looked at the economics closely enough to know that a convention headquarters hotel will grow this economy. I mean, it is a net economic benefit to the community, but there are some equity concerns. And I think the productive middle place to be is how do you address those equity concerns?
How come the Republicans are all into equity concerns when in great hotel management guys, but you get back to minimum wage and, you know.
Okay, well, speaking of minimum wage, Jim, in this legislative session.
Minimum wage?
Executive pay may come up. I don't know. There are going to be some bills to raise the governor's salary, and you've got some strong feelings there. And I'm prepared to go to bat for you. Go to bat against you on this, but let's hear your point.
Well, my point is that I, frankly, do the legislative work for the money. And when I found out how little legislators are paid, it became difficult. So the question is, it's not the governor's proposal. And I think it's fair to point that out. But there is a proposal by some commission or committee or somebody that says we ought to raise the governor's salary by 39%. I'm for it, provided he goes to $10 an hour on the minimum wage. If he does it, I say give him the extra money. Otherwise, it's obscene to talk about increasing the governor's wage 39% unless you're going to do something for the real working people that are trying to live on.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. Can you live on $10 an hour, Jim?
No.
Okay. So the point about the minimum wage is it was never – I honestly think you have to have a starting wage for people. I think this has and let those employers pay for the good work that they receive, and you would be crazy as a businessman to try and starve out good employees working for you. And so the minimum wage, it sounds good. It may be intuitive to some, but rubber hits the road. I'm still convinced that good business owners – pay for what they get. This state, it's a constitutional compensation commission, because what politician would ever want to suggest a raise for themselves? Nobody would.
Yeah.
So you have a third party that looks at the compensations of governors around this country, and they have suggested that this amount be raised. It goes back to you get what you pay for, okay? I absolutely believe in hiring good executive officers to help run this state.
That's true.
I think that that the minimum wage is artificial. It doesn't take any of that into account, and they don't have anything to do with each other. It's nice political pageantry, but I don't believe that there's a true nexus between the two issues.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. On the left is Jim DeBacchus, and on the right, Greg Hughes. Greg, that was a great term, political pageantry. I loved it. I mean, I think Jim is mixing two different issues, but we'll just leave it at that. Jim's smiling. He's going to let me leave it at that.
I'm happy.
Let's talk about a more substantive issue here for just a second, Medicaid expansion. And this comes up from time to time, but the new news out there is that the Utah Hospital Association's come to an agreement. And that's a big deal because you've got competing healthcare systems and the insurance industry, whatnot, and they basically they've proposed a hybrid system that takes care of everybody up to 100% of the federal poverty level, and then uses premium subsidies for other folks from 100 to 138% of the federal poverty level. It supports the private system. It will help us not have these crowd out effects where, you know, people go into Medicaid when they really could have employer sponsored insurance. I think it's a pretty good compromise, and I'm liking what I'm seeing, Jim.
Wow. It right now the people under 100% are covered anyway. So
not all kids are, but
that's
adults
right.
There,
there's a group of people that will be covered under this. But what this is a system that preserves, protects, and defends the insurance companies. They're making sure they get the dough. They are in there defending and making sure that they get their premiums. We need to put the emphasis on that from 100 to 138% of the people on the people that are disadvantaged and are living on really tough salaries. Insurance companies will take care of themselves. This is really the Protect the Insurance Companies Act, and it just so happens that a few people will benefit. It's completely the wrong approach.
Greg, I'll bet you disagree.
Do I ever? Here's the problem. We have this Affordable Care Act that's been foisted on every state to try and manage. The Supreme Court decision, an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, said that the states could not be compelled in certain ways to accept this expansion of Medicaid. It has had the result or the effect of creating a donut hole. Natalie, exactly what you said. Those that don't have children or dependents are uncovered through the way ACA is being enforced. Now, how? That is the state's problem. How it would grow Medicaid costs for this state, which already those costs are growing or taking a bigger portion of our state budget on its own before you talk about this, how we take on that extra cost and that accelerated pace of eating up the rest of our budget, I don't know. If there is a bill that the president passed, Congress passed, that created a donut hole, you deal with it. You deal with what problem that you've created.
If you
asking the states to bail it out, giving a three-year promise of, oh, pinky swear, we'll pay for this moving forward, but we're going to give you a 3 years and only. It is, I mean, if you believe that, Jim, where's that bridge that we're gonna sell you? Where is it?
Christie's blocking it. No, if you accepted the Medicaid expansion, you wouldn't have this problem of covering the people that the state has never covered on the under 100%. So the reasonable thing to do is what Chris Christie did, and the mayor of Florida or the governor of Florida and Jan, what's her name, in Arizona, and so many, and the governor of Ohio, Kasich. It is to do the reasonable thing, which is Utah's paying millions of dollars in additional taxes to Washington. We ought to take them back and not give them to Jan Brewer in Arizona. That's the reasonable thing to do. It's 3 years at 100%. Then they're going to keep it. The state can pay a maximum of 10%. It is just bad public policy to not get in there. We're losing $163,000 a day starting January 1st.
We will be talking about this session and Medicaid expansion for the next month and a half. Time for our weekly gripes, and I got cut out last week, so I'm going to start out here. And I've got a real simple one. I did an interview this week with Al Jazeera America. It's the first time I've ever done an interview with Al Jazeera. I thought it was kind of cool. They were in Salt Lake. And Al Jazeera to me is like this, you know, foreign, you know,
best friend
cutter.
Of Jim.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, I, you know, and they were in town for Sundance and they did a story on NSA and they did a story on gay marriage and they wanted to talk to me about the Utah economy. But my gripe is that they asked me what's the single biggest risk affecting the Utah economy. And the only answer to that is lack of federal leadership in Washington, D.C. That's my gripe.
My gripe is going up to Park City and back and forth a lot the last few days or going south. Who are these people that don't understand that that left lane is not just your personal lane? And people are swerving out and honking and swearing at you, and they just keep driving there in the passing lane like it's their God-given right to be in that lane. Get out of there when you're not passing.
Okay, and Greg?
Okay, I got criticized last week because I have very, you know, superficial rants, but here we go again. We got a very thoughtful comment from a listener. Very, very offended by me because, Jim, when I refer to the Democrat Party, I refer to it just like that, the Democrat Party. Apparently, the proper vernacular is Democratic Party. However, I see the word Democrat everywhere. I don't know how that word, dropping the IC, is so offensive. Isn't there an issue I brought up that's more offensive? Isn't there something I've said beyond Democratic versus Democrat?
So you didn't like my letter?
No, I didn't. I just thought you were parsing words with me, Jim.
I love it. Well, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. It's produced by Tyler Ford and Elizabeth Dee. Thanks for listening.